Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I'm your host, Graham Culbertson. I'm willing to say I'm giddy about the interview you're about to hear. My guest was Paul Schrader. Now, Paul Schrader is a legend in the cinema world for three reasons. First, and most famously, he was the screenwriter of some of the greatest films in Hollywood history, including Raging Bull and Taxi Driver, a couple of Martin Scorsese, Robert De Niro collaborations. But in addition to being a screenwriter, Paul Schrader is a legendary film director, and at least two of his films, Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters, and the more recent First Reformed from 2017, are, as far as I'm concerned, among the greatest films ever made. But before he was a legendary screenwriter and before he was a legendary director, Paul Schrader was a film critic and essayist, and he wrote what is, to my mind, one of the best books ever written about film. It's called Transcendental Style in Film. And it's a book that I have been interested in since I first read it decades ago. And in that book, and especially in the new 2018 introduction to the book, Schrader advances a theory of a certain kind of cinema that I would say is democratic, is non-hierarchical, is everyday anarchist. At least that's what I think, and in the interview you're about to hear, I try these ideas out with Paul. I think you will enjoy it. I certainly enjoyed it very much. Thanks so much for doing this. This is a huge pleasure and honor. So let me tell you a little bit about what led me to invite you on the podcast, and then we can just talk from there, which is, I've always been a huge cinema fan, and I'm on this project called Everyday Anarchism, which is just trying to rethink, a lot of things. I'm having fun with it. And I was watching, I think I watched, I rewatched the, what's it called? The Ryan Coogler movie, Black Panther, after I've been watching like nothing but Ozu and Bresson for like a few weeks. And it just struck me as an assault. You know, I just felt attacked by the movie, dominated by it.
I mean, the distinction is that movie going is possibly the laziest art experience there is. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to turn a page. You don't have to read. You don't have to go any place. You can lie on your sofa. And the successful films do all the thinking for you. And as the music, it tells you when to be afraid. It tells you when to be exhilarated. It tells you when to feel romantic. It leaves literally nothing up to you. So when you've been watching films that require that you become part of the process, and then you jump back into conventional cinema that doesn't really care if you're part of the process because the process has already been established. And it's just telling you what to do. So I think that's probably the kind of culture shock you felt.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And from that moment, I was kind of looking for, some vocabulary for this. And I just happened to watch your introduction to Pickpocket. And you were comparing Pickpocket to Pickup on South Street on the for Criterion, and you said something like Sam Fuller, reaches through the screen and grabs you and tosses you around, and that my feeling of an assault. You were describing it perfectly right there.
Yeah, Bresson works pretty much the opposite way, which is he deals in dead time. The movies, of course, are another art that's based on time, in a certain time period. It's not like a book or a painting, types of music where you can listen to it as much as you want. You are limited by this time frame. And filmmakers very carefully manipulate that time frame. So the first time I became aware of these distancing devices, devices that push you away, was in Pickpocket, because normally when someone walks out of a room, the editor splices just before the door closes. And Bresson would let the door close and then count, you know, one, two, three, and then splice. Well, what was he doing? What was happening? Nothing was happening, but time was happening. And he was changing your concept of time in order to change your concept of your involvement. And then, you know, as a slow cinema progressed, you got even more exaggerated examples. You know, where they wouldn't wait 3 seconds, they'd wait 10 seconds, you know. So that the main distancing device is the pushback against the requirement of time. So Pickpocket was a 75-minute film, but it feels like an hour, yeah, like a two-hour film. And then there are all the other distancing devices, you know, planimetric compositions where you don't have much foreground, background, center punching, all this stuff, all the tricks that create an emotion or dictate an emotion. You take them away, and so you have to more and more decide, what do I feel about this character? Isn't acting. He isn't giving me any hints of how I should feel about him. And yet I'm fascinated by him, so I guess I better start paying attention. And I think that's the secret of this slow cinema, the cinema of audience involvement.
Let me say this. I mean, this was thrilling to me. And then when I went and read the introduction to the new edition of Transcendental Style in Film.
Yeah, where I'm talking about just what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yes. And I noticed, I mean, you mentioned the word dictate just there, but I noticed political terms all throughout that introduction. So in conventional cinema, you say that certain forms of composition govern what the audience looks at. So slow cinema is ungoverned. You mentioned democracy. And so suddenly this collision of these political terms of this and this aesthetic style it exploded in my head, thinking about Brecht as well, who you mention. And now we're in the thick of what I'm interested in, but please feel free to just say, you know, whatever about this collision.
I had not thought of it that way. That was just the vocabulary that occurred to me at the time. Motion pictures are not democratic. You're not supposed to have a choice of how you feel. You are paying money to be told and led down a certain path. And the most effective films of this nature make you think that you are part of the process, when in fact you are simply reacting.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm really struck by the fact that you weren't using political language consciously. I mean, I made a list: direct, you mentioned dictate, democracy, the viewer acts upon the image, the viewer is operative, the viewer's participation. You know, these are all things that people who are interested in like radical democracy or Occupy Wall Street would say about the political process. And here we are in film.
Well, I guess the political process the entertainment process, which is what you're talking about in films. Politics, people want it, they want you to get to vote in a certain way, and filmmakers, they want you to get your money in a certain way. And so they use similar techniques, including false expectations, misleading advertising, anything to get you into the theater.
Yeah, and so the next thing, and I'm kind of skeptical of this myself, but one thing you could do with this is to sort of do this like sort of schematic, like transcendental style or slow cinema is left wing or democratic, and conventional cinema contains the seeds of authoritarianism within it. I'm skeptical of that in terms of like actual politics, you know, but I wanted to see what you thought about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, when they have test screenings for a reason, they want to make sure that the audience, they are maximizing the possibilities to control the audience. And if they have a test screening and the audience gets bored or listless, that's the first thing that shows up in the conversation afterward. Right around minute 35, started losing it. What can we do? Can we cut something? Can we add something? Can we change the music? And so that's not dissimilar from how politicians feel about their constituents.
Yeah, I think that's right. I'm not, I just want to be clear to everyone listening. I'm not making the argument that a filmmaker who's making a film in the conventional style, a Hitchcock or Christopher Nolan, is a fascist. That is not the claim. But
no, he's just a control freak.
Well, that's it. That's it, isn't it? The goal of the director in a conventional cinema is to control the audience, not necessarily to nefarious ends. Maybe to beautiful ends, but the control lies in the hand of the auteur, which is another word for authority.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to give the audience the illusion that they are in some peril, and then relieve that peril as if they had some say in the matter. You're talking about Hitchcock perfectly, Hitchcock's always trying to convince you that the more involved you get in the story, the more likely it will turn out in your favor.
Yeah, and this is fascinating because we know that no matter how many times we watch the movie and no matter how we feel about it, and you can decide that you want James Mason to kill Cary Grant in North by Northwest, but it doesn't matter if you decide that. It doesn't matter at all. Hitchcock is always in control.
Yeah, and it's not a idiosyncratic control. Is very calculated control. Some directors, you would say Almodovar is in control. Yes, he's in control, but he is not seeking a simplistic control. It's a kind of complicated control where he interacts with your feelings. Hitchcock was the height of simplistic control. If you do not feel X, at point Y, he's made a mistake.
Yeah. Okay. So this opens up another thing that I wanted to ask you about. There was a the opening editorial in Sight and Sound a few months ago, where the editor of Sight and Sound, I think his name is Mike Williams, he complained that people are laughing in screenings, for example, when Hannibal Lecter is giving speeches in Silence of the Lambs, people are laughing. And, he says something like, I have the quote somewhere, let me see if I can find it. He says, it's an affront to the art, a hostile act against both the intentions of the film and the audience experience.
Well, I didn't read that article, but the reason they're laughing is because Silence of the Lambs is no longer a movie. It's a kind of cultural artifact. And it invites this new response. And believe me, nobody was laughing when it came out.
Yes, I...
But now it's become a kind of meta experience, and almost like the midnight feature, you know, where people go to make fun of a movie, like Rocky Horror Show. They go to make fun of it, and I would suspect that's what's happening to a film like Silence of the Lambs, because it's been so copied and now appears so derivative, when in fact it once was original, that it's almost comically derivative.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. And we have a name for this, and it's camp. I mean, Susan Sontag, and it's fascinating because when Sontag writes that essay, Notes on Camp, she says something like, maybe someday people will find the acting of James Dean ironically hilarious. But I can tell you, Paul, my students do find, like, it happens. And you're in the same position of, like, I don't know, like Augustus trying to maintain Roman morals when you say, no, children, you're not allowed to laugh at Hannibal Lecter. You're defying the intent of the director.
Yeah. I mean, if people laugh when a film is coming out for the first time, it's clearly the director has made a mistake and he's left something so implausible or so mediocre in the film that the only proper response is to fight back with laughter. It's just like watching a terrible performance, or, you know, a woman pretending to be frightened who clearly doesn't even know how to act frightened. What are you going to do? You're going to laugh. Now, when that thing starts to become meta, you know, so that we change our attitude, you know, now we revisit cinema. This is a very interesting point. Cinema didn't, for a long time, cinema never thought about the future. And when I was editing a film magazine in the 70s, I did a thing on, what's his name? The guy who did Gun Crazy.
Oh, God.
Big combo. Joseph Lewis.
Yes.
And I was talking to Joseph Lewis, and he said, who cares about those old movies anyway? Nobody sees them. And, he had been making films in the pre-rep cinema era, where a film existed and then it was gone. And so when the Boston Film Society started programming Casablanca in the 60s, they were dealing with a film that was 20 years old and was gone. Today, a film that's 20 years old, it is almost as present as a film right now.
Yeah, and I mean, I would say, to put it another way, certain 20-year-old films loom much larger than certain films that have just come out. You know, it does seem like we're living in this sort of like ancient Rome of cinema, where some buildings are built over right away and have, you know, they're lost, and other buildings will stand forever, and you're sort of wandering among the ruins and the new and the newly renovated all at the same time.
So the idea of movies having a shelf life has changed our fundamental perception of them. Because when, you know, people like Hawks and Ford, Cukor were all working, they weren't thinking about shelf life. They were thinking about, you know, how long is it going to play in the theater?
Yeah, and so then the audience, the immediate audience reaction is, in some ways, all that matters.
All that matters.
What is it? In Sullivan's Travels, where Sullivan is meeting with the executive, and he says whatever it played at the music hall or something, and they said, "Well, they hated it in Pittsburgh."
It's hard to, for film students today to even imagine a pre-rep era, particularly if they have studied film. You know, they think of certain films as we would think of Hemingway or Fitzgerald or Dickens. They're always going to be there. You know, Antonioni and Renoir are always going to be there. Well, and Renoir didn't feel that way at the time.
Well, I mean, to go back to the sense of if the audience is laughing, if the audience is laughing at a new movie, the director has made a mistake. I would just say, I think if the whole audience is laughing, but we have the other problem, this other political problem of pluralism, which someone asked that I get kicked out of a movie theater when I was a teenager, and it didn't work because I worked at the movie theater because I was watching The Last Samurai, which I actually thought was a pretty good movie, but there are shots of Tom Cruise in samurai armor that are just as loving as anyone has ever filmed anyone, and I just found it so funny, and that was my authentic reaction. I wasn't there to heckle the movie, you know? I just thought it was funny, and other audience members were being carried along and were angry that I was laughing, and this is where you need a film dictator to come in and kick me
Now,
out of the movie because I'm not respecting the author's vision.
this movie wasn't made for you. Would you please leave?
Yes. And this is, I mean, again, it's a quasi-political thing. It's like a Hobbesian thing. Like, you are violating the social contract, and the Leviathan must ask you to stop laughing at Tom Cruise so that everyone else can enjoy the political experience. And obviously from this thing that Mike Williams wrote in Sight and Sound, it's almost like it's a political problem. There's different factions who want different things in the polity of cinema going. Okay, so that sounds good to you then, I guess. I'm just trying these ideas out. Most of them are I've never tried out before, so I thought you were the person to ask.
Wait a minute. It sounds right. I mean, I'm in the process right now of, or later today, I'm going to see the first cut of my new film. First time I see it all together, the first time I see it with strangers in the room. And so, you know, I'm prepared. You know, there's a saying in the film business, no film is as good as the dailies or as bad as the first cut. And I'm about to see the first cut, and you see things that, you know, in a normal thing, you see things that you want to fix, but you also ha have to make those critical decisions. Do you want to answer certain questions? How do you want them to feel at the end? Like ending the First Reformed? Is he alive or is he dead? I don't know. I don't want to have to make that decision. I want the viewer to make that decision. And when we had screens of the film, I would ask people put up their hands who thought he was alive, people put up their hands thought he was dead. And when we re started reaching about an equilibrium, I knew we were at the right point. Now, that would be anathema to a more dictatorial approach, letting the audience sort of decide, not answering certain questions. I'm one of the things I'm going to decide today. One of the characters in my new film, he's asked what brought you to the city. And he says, guns, I have a gun shop. Now, there are no guns in the movie, and there are no more mention of guns. So that is a deliberate mockery of Chekhovian principle that if you have a gun in the first act, you have to use it in the third. And so I'm going to see in a few hours whether anybody says, well, what about the gun shop? And if one person says that, I guess I'll have to cut it out.
This is even more. I mean, thank you so much for speaking about your current process and that thing in First Reformed, because this is again another analog to people, trying out policies and seeing how the voters respond. Someone wrote, I think it's James C. Scott, who's an anarchist academic, wrote that when MLK would give his speeches, everyone praised his charisma and his speeches, but in fact, he tweaked the speech every time he gave it based on the moments that the audience gave him amens and supports and didn't. And so even a charismatic speaker like King was honing in, was in some ways directed by the audience. I guess that means even someone like Hitchcock, or he if he determines this film is going to be this way and then the audience doesn't like it, then Hitchcock has to reshoot or recut.
He has to recalculate, figure out whether how the problem can be fixed. And there's a similar thing with this concept of improvisation. People talk about improvisation. There is very, very little improvisation in a film. It does occur in the film process, but it occurs in rehearsals. Occasionally, once or twice, three times in a film, someone will say something off the cuff and it turns out to be really clever and good and it stays in. One of my favorite examples is in what's the Dustin Hoffman, Tom Cruise film, Rain Man.
Rain Man, yeah.
Yeah, well, they were in a phone booth together. And Dustin had a fart. And rather than cut the scene, they just worked it into the dialogue. Now, you can't plan that in advance. If you did, it probably wouldn't be as good. Another one, it's a movie where a heist movie, Harry Dean Stanton is pulling money out of the bank. He says, look at all this. There's 10s, 20s, 30s. Oh, no, there's no 30s. There is no 30s. Now, you could see him correcting himself, and then it became a funny line on the spot. But most of what we call improvisation, particularly something like Cassavetes, has been worked out. Cassavetes would rehearse ad infinitum, and then when he got to shoot it, he had probably rehearsed it in four or five different ways. And so you think, oh, it's called improvisation because they're changing it as they're going. No, they're just moving through different possibilities that they've already thought about. And so if he says a line that way, then I can go the way we did on Tuesday, or I can go the way we did on Wednesday.
I mean, I'm thinking of one of my favorites. And speaking of repertory cinema, our local cinema here in Chapel Hill is showing Agnes Varda's The Gleaners and I in a couple of weeks, and I'm going, of course. And when you get into a documentary mode, it seems like things are mostly different. I mean, there's certainly ways that documentaries are more and less staged. There's the Errol Morris reenactment tradition and all that thing, but I take Varda's films and certain other documentary films to be almost improvisational, but would you say that like the editing process just renders that still somehow under the control of the director?
Well, documentaries have gone through an important change. They have moved from informational to entertainment. So, and one of the most lucrative streaming techniques is true crime. That's where the money is. That's why there's so much of it. And Netflix makes its money on true crime. And true crime is based on a formula, and it's based on an entertainment formula. It's not propaganda or films you saw when you were in school about how they make wheat, stuff like that. This is strictly entertainment disguised as important information.
Yeah, and I guess there's also a, I would say there's still, I mean, now you mentioned this in the intro, there's also this a slow cinema tradition of documentary that is neither entertainment nor information presented, and that's where you get sort of almost like a museum type thing.
Yeah, and it is, speaking of museums, it's pretty hard to go into a museum today and not see a movie.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about a movie, I'm talking about a flat screen installation, which we used to think of as movies, but now we think of also as art.
Yeah, there was at UNC Chapel Hill where I work for a few years. It's gone now. There was an installation in the front room that was, I think it was like 12 different projectors running. It was a lot, and it was just sunrises from all over the world on infinite repeat. And boy, is that something in the like Tarkovsky or tradition, right? This sense of like, Tarkovsky would have put it in a narrative film, although he would have made it much longer and slower than anyone had ever imagined having a sunrise in a narrative film before. And then this artist, I should look up their name so I can show people a link to it. This artist is like, let's do this all over the world and try and give it a subtle social element and just run it on the wall of the Ackland Art Museum for years.
As if you're in a plane at the exact speed of the rotation of the Earth, and the sun never fully sets and never fully rises.
Yes. Yeah, and this is obviously playing with time in a way that previous filmmakers couldn't afford to do. If it had to sell in Pittsburgh, you could not play with time that way because the Yinzers would say no.
And there was no concept then that movies could perform in that manner, as different art forms, rather than just as a narrative roller coasters. So the concept of slow cinema is fairly new, and I say in that book it really began with the post-war cinema. With the Italians, they started to slow it down, and it worked, and bit by bit. And then I don't know if slow cinema is now on the rise or the fall. I think it's on the fall now, but it will never go away. There will always be a market for slow cinema.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that. I agree there will always be a market, but you also say in the book that some part of the market is not an audience-based market. It's an art and institution market, and that has been an enormous shift. I mean, MoMA, I guess, has been in the institutional film business for a long time, but not many others b besides MoMA for decades.
Yeah, well, like I say, I was just in Kansas City at the I did a film in Kansas City, and I was at the Modern Art Museum there, and there were screens everywhere.
Yeah.
I said, doesn't anybody paint anymore?
So before we move on, I actually want to ask you some questions about transcendental style and Dreyer maybe, but I do want to come back to music because that's one that I forgot to mention. As I was reading your like list of characteristics of slow cinema in the introduction, and you mentioned, Bresson's rule of no music and how music is almost like an emo it's like the ultimate emotional manipulation, and that reminded me that in Plato's Republic, this is precisely how music works. They go through the list of the different kinds of music and the different emotions that you have to feel when you hear these. He says there's no choice. You have to feel these emotions. And Socrates says, well, figure out the music that gives us the emotions that we approve of, and they can have that. And the emotions we disapprove of can never be heard in the Republic.
And another trick that slow cinema uses, which is not only no music when you expect it, but bursts of music when you don't expect it. So, like, Ozu shows a shadow, a hallway, and a flower, and there's this swell of music. Where he's just had a scene where Setsuko is breaking down in tears, no music at all. Now he shows a hallway, and it's music. But he's, obviously, he's clearly fucking with your programming.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that goes into the next thing I wanted to ask you about transcendental style, which is in the book, in the original book, there's the suggestion, not, I mean, not the suggestion, the clear statement that Dreyer's, I'm not quite sure, is Dreyer how you say that name? That's how I would Germanically say it. That Dreyer's cinema is caught between a few modes, and it sort of leaves a door open for the audience. And that made me think that the transcendental style, as you've described it in Ozu and Bresson, and I have to say I'm quite convinced. I've taught this many times. I love that book, and it also seems ultimately that it's the viewer has the choice to take what Bresson and Ozu are portraying or walk away in a way that you are not supposed to have a choice in Hitchcock, but to get it, they have to sort of go along on this route to transcendence. And Dreyer, of your three examples, is the one who says at the end of his films, especially of Audette, here, viewer, I'm not going to push you towards transcendence. I'm going to allow you to choose or deny transcendence.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the concept of does at the end of a film, does an artist open a door or does he push you through the door? If he opens a door for you and you walk through, you have participated and you have changed. If he yanks you through the door himself, you still have no volition. At the end of or that your dryer opens the door, says the door is wide open. In fact, that's the last line of a film I did, Light Sleeper, where the song says, the door is open wide, now I step inside. So I've always been interested in those kind of endings.
Well, now, so first of all, I should just say I love Light Sleeper. I mean, I'm a huge fan of your films, Paul. I didn't want to lead off with that. I wanted to stick, but I love the work you've done. Thank you so much for all of it. I'm wondering now about the end of The Searchers, because that's one where the door is closed. I mean, do you think it's the same sort of thing? Does the viewer have a choice at the end of The Searchers?
Yeah, the viewer has a choice, which is Ethan Edwards, too. They see he is being shut out of the home. And the choice of the viewer is that's unfair. I'd rather be out there with him than in this house. And so part of what Ford is saying is, wouldn't you rather be walking with the Duke then in this perfectly hermetic space?
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. It's the viewer's choice whether they want that domestic confinement or the open, beautiful brutality, I suppose. Those are the options. And I would argue that Ford is closer to the transcendental style than someone like Hawks or even Kurosawa. There's something open-ended. There's something wide. The viewer's attention is forced, I think, less in Ford than most of those other old Hollywood filmmakers. I don't know if that sounds right to you.
Well, you also have to bear in mind that artists can have multiple careers.
Yes.
Bergman had three of them. Rossellini had three of them. Bergman had two. So you talk about Dreyer. There is the silent Dreyer, and that is one tradition. And then he mo slowly morphed into a different kind of director. So you're talking about early Dreyer or late Dreyer, there's almost two directors there. How did he come to do that? And when did Antonioni become Antonioni? Did Godard become Godard?
Oh, Godard had a, there's a lot of Godards as well. I mean, that's
But there's only one that's any good.
yeah. Oh man, I agree with you on that, but maybe we shouldn't see if we if we agree on the same Godard that's any good.
Oh, this whole question of how artists change. And it is possible, Ozu be in like comedy. It is possible to have a period where you're in this style and then go out of that period or just become no good at it anymore. As I said in that essay, there's a whole buffet of techniques at your disposal, and different artists pick at them in different ways. They're all trying to distance you in some ways to make you lean forward, because your classic approach to the filmmaking is let the viewer lean back. You just let them roll back, and we'll do everything for you. And all these distancing devices are saying, if you lean a little bit forward, you're going to see more, and because you're missing something, we're holding something back from you, we're not telling you something, and you have to pay more attention.
This description is exactly what I have been looking for, and why your work called to me so much, because it is the question. James C. Scott, who I mentioned earlier, one of the things he says is if we move to a more anarchist, or you could just say democratic society, people would have to do more. Like the government may not be so great at picking up the trash without all of the tools of coercion and planning that the government has. And it does seem that historically people don't want to figure out about the trash. They want someone else to take care of it, and they don't want to figure out the meaning of movies. They want someone else to take care of it.
And they want stoplights. They want to know when it's green and when it's red.
Yeah.
I hate those intersections where you have to figure it out.
Where you have to slow down and look and see if you're going to run over anyone, and with your own, choice, decide whether you should go or not. I mean, this is actually one of James C. Scott's examples, is traffic circles and other forms of intersections that demand your attention and require you to make a choice are a very commonplace, everyday example of what he's describing. And I think slow cinema, surprising, maybe not surprising to me because I've been thinking about this, but surprising to others, works like traffic circles. You have to figure it out. Hitchcock can't tell you.
I think I'll leave off on that insight.
Well, I mean, you nailed the traffic lights was utterly perfect. But would you like to say something about the new film while you're here?
It's called The Basics of Philosophy,
Oh.
and the character I've written about at various times, whether he be a taxi driver or a drug dealer or a poker player, he's now a professor of philosophy at a Midwestern university. And he has a girlfriend who is a fellow professor, but he lives a kind of monastic aesthetic life. And then you come to realize his father dies, and at the funeral, he sees this handsome Hispanic man, well dressed, and he recognizes him. And it's the boy he had molested 12 years earlier. And his father covered it all up. And so he tracks this man down, who turns out to be homosexual, so they meet in a gay bar, they go to a coffee shop. And he said, "Why did you come to my father's funeral?" And he said, "I would not have anything if it wasn't for your father. Your father supported my family. Your father came to my high school graduation, my college graduation. He paid for my education. He paid for our rent. Your father had two families. How could I not come? And he had never known that his father had been doing this for a dozen years to make up for his sin as a grad student. Of course, then Jack is out of the box.
All right, that sounds wonderful. Basic of philosophy. I'll be on the lookout for it. Thank you so much, Paul. I really, really
All right,
appreciate
Graham.
you taking the time.
Thank you. Ciao, ciao.
Bye now. That's the end of the interview. I'm still giddy. And this is where, when I do an outro, I usually say the music you're about to hear is by David Hill, and it is. But I also want to say that David and I have had countless conversations about our shared admiration for the work of Paul Schrader. So the music you're about to hear is by my fellow Paul Schrader fan, David Hill.